This is Lecture 9 from the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner, Human Values in Education, entitled Renewing Education, given on July 24, 1924, in the afternoon. It can truly be said that the accomplishments of our schools becomes a part of the whole culture and development of civilization. It does this either in a more direct way, so that we can easily see it in the way a civilization is expressed in its art of education, or it may go unnoticed. Civilization always reflects the nature of its schools, but this often goes unobserved. We will describe this through the example of our own era, but first we will discuss Eastern culture. We really know very little about the more ancient Eastern culture and what remains of it. Eastern culture has absolutely no intellectual aspect, but arises directly from the human being as a whole, in an Eastern form, and its goal is to unite human beings. It rises above the principle of authority only with great difficulty, and its forms tend to arise from love in a natural way. We cannot speak of a separate teacher and a separate student in the Eastern world as we would in our culture. There you do not have the teacher, but a dada. The dada shows the way through personality and represents all that should imbue a growing human being. The dada is the one who shows everything and never teaches anything. It would make no sense to teach in Eastern culture. The educational views of Herbart, a well-known educational theorist in Europe, were widely accepted in Central Europe. Footnote: Johann Friedrich Herbart, 1776 to 1841, philosopher and pedagogue. End of footnote. Herbart once stated that he could not imagine education without teaching. To him, everything revolved around what one thinks. The Eastern individual would not have been able to imagine an education based on teaching, because everything that should develop in students was presented through a living example. This is also true of the relationship between an initiate or guru and a chela or disciple. The disciple is not taught but learns through example. By going more deeply into this, you will understand this. All Waldorf education is directed toward the whole human being. Our purpose is not to separate spiritual and physical education. But when we educate the body, our education even affects illnesses and the ramifications. Our physical education employs fundamental spiritual principles, which are also very practical. Our purpose is to allow spirit to work actively within the body. Thus, in a Waldorf school, physical education is not neglected, but developed from our knowledge that human beings are soul and spirit. In every way, our education involves everything needed to educate the body. Furthermore, one must come to understand something that was understood by the ancient Greeks, whose education was based on gymnastics. The teachers were gymnasts, and they knew the meaning of human movement. In earlier Greek times, it would have been virtually incomprehensible to think that they should introduce children to logic. The Greeks understood the healthy results of teaching children gymnastics, in a milder form in Athens, and in a more difficult and arduous way in Sparta. It was perfectly clear to them that if they could use their fingers in a dexterous way when taking hold of something, the movement would flow into their whole organism, and through the agile use of their limbs, they could learn to think clearly. One also learns to speak well by performing gymnastic movements in the correct way. Everything involved in inner spiritual training that tends toward abstraction develops unnaturally through direct instruction. This sort of training should arise from the way we learn to move our bodies, and this is why our civilization has become so abstract. Today there are those who cannot sew on a button. In Waldorf schools, the boys and girls are together, and the boys become enthusiastic about knitting and crocheting. Through this, they also learn to manipulate their thoughts. It is not surprising that people, regardless of their training and logical thinking, cannot think clearly if they are incapable of knitting. We can see that the thinking of today's women is much more flexible. One merely needs to look at the results of admitting women to universities to see how much more flexible the soul of women is than that of men, who have become stiff and abstract through activities that lead away from reality. We see this in its worst form in the business world. seeing how a man of business conducts his affairs, can drive you crazy. These things must be understood again today. Teachers must know that no matter how much they draw on the blackboard or provide intellectual explanations, children will learn to tell the difference between acute and obtuse angles and come to understand the world much better if they practice holding a pencil between their toes, for example, to make reasonably formed angles and letters. In other words, when human spirit flows from the whole body. Greek culture carefully taught children how to move, to endure heat and cold, and to adapt to the physical world, because there was a feeling that soul and spirit develop correctly from a properly developed physical body. Greeks were educated as gymnasts. They grasped and mastered the whole person. The outer faculties were allowed to develop from such mastery. Because of modern scientific thinking, we are aware of an important fact, but we understand it in only an abstract way. When children are quick to learn how to write with the right hand, we know that this is related to the human center of speech in the left hemisphere of the brain. We see a connection between hand movement and speech. Similarly, through physiology, we can understand the relationship between movement and thinking. So today we already know, though in a somewhat abstract way, how thinking and speaking arise from the human faculty of movement. But the Greeks knew this in a most comprehensive sense. Gymnasts knew people learned to think in a coordinated way by learning to skillfully walk, jump, and throw a discus. When one learns to throw the discus beyond the goal, one can comprehend the logic behind the story of Achilles and the tortoise. One learns to grasp the remarkable forms of logic that the Greeks described. In this way, one learns to stand firm in reality. Today, we generally think something along these lines. Here is a lawyer, and there is the client. The lawyer knows that the client does not. The lawyer knows things that the client does not. In Greece, however, because it was usual to throw the discus beyond the mark, the Greeks understood something like this. Here is an educated lawyer with a student whom he instructs in legal matters. The student learned so well that he can never lose a lawsuit. But what would happen if a lawsuit involved both student and teacher? The student would always win and always lose, of course. The case would be left hanging in the air. Thus, thinking and speaking developed from an education based on gymnastics. Both were drawn from the whole human being. Now consider the Roman civilization in which the whole person receded into the background, though something remained in the mannerism of the Roman. Greek movement was alive, pristine, and natural. The Romans in their togas looked very different from the Greeks. They also moved differently because their movement had become a mannerism. In place of movement, education was directed toward only a part of the human being. It was based on beautiful speech. This was still very significant because in speech the whole upper part of the body is engaged, right down into the diaphragm and bowels. A considerable part of a person is engaged while learning to speak with beauty. In education, every effort was made to approach the human being, to make something of the human being. This was still true when culture passed into medieval times. In Greece, the most important educators were the gymnasts, who worked on the whole person. In the Roman civilization, the most important educators were the rhetoricians. In Greece, all culture and worldviews were based on human beauty, conceived as a whole. We cannot understand a Greek poem or statue if we do not know that the Greek's whole worldview was centered on the concept of the human being in movement. When we look at a Greek statue and see the movement of the mouth, we are led to wonder about the relationship between that movement and the position of the foot, and so on. It is completely different when we consider Roman art and culture. There, rhetoricians replaced the gymnasts, with the entire cultural life focused on oratory. All education was to train public speakers to develop beautiful speech and eloquence. This continued right into the Middle Ages, when education still worked on the human being. You can see the truth of this by understanding the substance and goals of education during the Middle Ages. They had the seven liberal arts, for example, grammar, rhetoric, dialectic, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy or astrology, and music. Jesuit training was the cultural stream that carried this into later times and to the present. From the beginning and into the 18th century, its main purpose to train, even drill, human beings to develop a powerful will and to place them as such into life. From the beginning, this was the aim of Jesuit culture, and it was only during the 19th century, to keep from falling behind others, that the Jesuits introduced the exact sciences into their teaching. Through these methods, the Jesuits developed strong, energetic characters, so much so that, even if you oppose Jesuitism, you have to wonder whether human beings could be trained to work today with such purpose for the good, as the Jesuits have trained people to work for the decadence of humankind. Arithmetic was not practiced as it is today. It was taught in order to develop a capacity of working with form and number. The study of music enabled students to gain a deeper experience of life as a whole. And astronomy helped students develop a capacity for cosmic thinking. All these studies approached the human being directly. Today's exact sciences played a negligible part in education. The idea that students should understand science was considered of little value. It is much more important to be able to move and speak and well and think and calculate. It was much more important to be able to move and speak well and to think and calculate. The acquisition of ready-made truth was less important. Hence the whole perspective of civilization developed in order to produce people who could play a role in public life and willingly to devote themselves to this. One was proud of those who could hold their own as public orators and who were thoroughly representative individuals. This trend in human development first appeared in the Roman civilization, when rhetoricians emerged from the gymnast. In a civilization based on rhetorical education, we see the tremendous value placed on everything significant in the area of speech. Now, try to look back at life as a whole during the Middle Ages, when everything was viewed from the perspective of rhetoric, and this gets into matters such as how to act, how to greet one another, and so on. All this is not taken for granted, but practiced according to a concept of beauty, just as in rhetoric one derives aesthetic pleasure from a way of speaking that conforms to a concept of beauty. Here you see the growing overall importance of an education in rhetoric, whereas the whole significance of a Greek education is based on expression through human movement. In the 16th century we come to a more modern period, though in fact we see some preparation for this in the 15th century. Again, something that represented much in a human being, in this case rhetoric, is pushed to the background. Just as rhetoric had pushed back gymnastic training, now rhetoric is pushed back and limited, leading to an ever-increasing effort toward intellectuality. Just as Roman educators were rhetoricians, our educators are doctors and professors. Gymnasts were complete human beings, and rhetoricians appeared in public wanting to represent human beings. But our professors have ceased to be human at all. They deny the human being and live increasingly through sheer abstractions. They are now merely skeletons of civilization. Today, professors dress like anyone else. They no longer like to wear cap and gown in the lecture halls, but dress in such a way that it is not immediately obvious that they are merely skeletons of civilization. Ever since the 16th century, our entire education has focused on the professor. And those who educate in terms of what is important in the world no longer bring to the schools any understanding of human development and training, but merely impart facts to the children. Children are expected to absorb knowledge. Real development is ignored, but they are expected to gain knowledge and acquire learning. Those in favor of educational reform certainly complain loudly enough about this academic attitude, but they cannot escape it. There are those who are fully aware of such matters and have a clear image of the way Greek children were educated. They see what happens in modern schools where, although gymnastics are taught, human development and training of the whole being is completely ignored, and scraps of scientific knowledge are instead given to the youngest children. And they see that it is not just the teachers who have become skeletons of civilization, or at least consider this an ideal or essential requirement, but now the little children also look as though they were mini-professors. And if we wish to express the difference between a Greek child and a modern child, one could say that a Greek child was human, and a modern child easily becomes a small professor. This is the major change in the world in terms of the formation and development of culture. We no longer look at the human being, but only at what we can present as facts that people can know and hold on to as information. Western civilization has developed downward to the point where gymnasts have descended to rhetoricians and rhetoricians to professors. We must discover the upward direction again. The most important words for modern education are these: professors must be replaced with something new. We must again turn our attention to the whole human being. Consider how this is expressed in the global significance of education. In Central Europe recently, there was a university with a professor of eloquence or rhetoric. If we look back to the early 19th century, we find these professors of eloquence in many places of learning. This was all that remained of the old rhetoric. At the university I am thinking of, there was a truly important person who was considered a professor of eloquence. But he would never have gotten anyone to listen to him if he had limited himself to this, because people no longer had the least interest in listening to eloquence. He lectured instead on Greek archaeology. In the university register he was listed as, quote, a professor of eloquence, unquote, but in fact one would hear only his lectures on Greek archaeology. He had to teach something that leads to knowledge, not to a capacity, and indeed this has become the ideal of modern teaching. It leads to a life in which people know a tremendous amount. In a world where people know so much, it hardly seems earthly anymore. People have much knowledge and little ability. The function is lacking that leads from knowledge to capacity. For example, you may study for the medical profession, and then comes the time for final examinations. You are told, officially, that you cannot do anything yet. You must now go through years of internship. But it is absurd that students are not taught during their first years so that they can do something from the beginning. Why would children learn to do arithmetic if they could only add? What is the purpose of knowing about a town if you know only what it looks like? Wherever we go, the point is to enter life. Professors lead away from life, not into it. An example shows us the significance of education in the world. When people attended the Olympic Games in Greece, it was still apparent what the Greeks valued so much. They recognized that only gymnasts could be schoolteachers. It was similar during the time of rhetoricians. And what about now? There are those who would like to bring the Olympic Games back to life, but this is merely a whimsy, since people no longer need them. They merely imitate those games superficially, and nothing can be gained by this. Something else penetrates right into human beings today. It is centered neither in our speech nor in our studied bearing and gestures, but is centered in thinking. Consequently, the significance that science has for the world today is demonic. This demonic quality arises from the popular belief that intellectual thinking furthers cultural development. Life is supposed to be shaped by theories. This is true of modern socialism, for example, whose whole tenor shapes life according to concepts. Marxism entered the world through a few clumsy preconceived ideas such as surplus value and the like, which were intended to form the basis for determining and ordering life. Nobody saw the real connections and consequences, but research into the whole is an absolute necessity. Consider a more westerly part of Central Europe. Decades ago there was a philosopher there whose teaching no longer contained anything living. He turned everything into concepts, believing that life could be formed conceptually, and he presented these beliefs in his lectures. He preferred Russian students, and he had many. His philosophy eventually took the form of Bolshevism. He himself remained an ordinary, upstanding, middle-class citizen. At the time he had no idea what he was doing by sowing the seed of his philosophy. Out of it grew the remarkable blossom of Bolshevism. The seed of Bolshevism was first sown in the universities of the West. It was sown in thoughts and in the abstract intellectual education of a rising generation. One who knows nothing about plants has no idea what will sprout from a seed. Likewise, people had no idea what would grow from the seed they planted. They failed to see the consequences until the seed had begun to grow, because people no longer understood life's great interrelationships. The real significance of modern intellectual education in the world is that it leads away from life. We see this by looking at certain external matters. We had books before the World War. Of course, one masters their content only by reading them or by making notes. Otherwise, they remain in the library, which is a cultural coffin. But when someone needs to produce a thesis, the books must be checked out. This happens in an external way, and one is happy if their content enters only the head and no further. This is the way things are everywhere. Now look at life. We have an economy, a legal system, and our culture. They all function, but think little about it. We no longer think about inner realities, but only about the balance sheet. What is the real concern of banking for our economy, or even our culture, when, for example, the accounts of schools are prepared? These contain the abstract figures of balance sheets. And what have these figures brought about in life? People are no longer personally connected to what they do. People have gradually reached the point where it makes no difference whether they are grain merchants or haberdashers. A pair of pants means as much as anything else. One merely calculates the profits of the business, searching through abstract figures with an eye for what might prove more lucrative. Banks have replaced the living economy. People draw money out of the banks, but apart from that, banking is left to economic abstractions. Everything has been changed into superficial abstractions, with the result that no one is involved in a human way. When banks were first established, it was closely connected to human beings, because people were used to living within the real work of existence, as was true in earlier times. Even during the first half of the 19th century, this was still true. Bank directors still gave it a personal character. They were actively engaged in it with their will. They lived with it as personalities. In this connection, I would like to relate a story that describes how the banker Rothschild behaved when the King of France sent a representative to arrange state credit. When the ambassador arrived, Rothschild was consulting with a leather dealer. The ambassador, who was concerned with arranging credit, was properly announced. Rothschild, whose business with the leather dealer had not finished, sent a message asking the ambassador to wait. The minister could not understand how an ambassador from the King of France could possibly be kept waiting, and he asked to be announced again. Rothschild replied that he was engaged in business concerning leather, not with state affairs. The minister became so angry that he burst into Rothschild's room, exclaiming, "I am the ambassador for the King of France." Rothschild replied, "Please, take a chair." The ambassador, thinking he had not heard correctly, could not conceive that someone in his position would be offered a chair. He repeated, "I am the ambassador for the King of France." But Rothschild merely replied, "Take two chairs, then." We see how the personality still made itself felt in those days, because it was still present. What about today? Personality is present in exceptional cases, for example, when someone breaks through as a public official. Otherwise, where there was once a personality, now there is a joint stock company. There is no human personality at the center of things. If we ask what a joint stock company is, the answer may be that it is a society of people who are wealthy today and poor tomorrow. Such matters follow a very different course today than they did in earlier times. Today wealth piles up, tomorrow it dissolves. People are cast here and there in these fluctuations, and money carries on its own business. Today people are delighted when they come into a great deal of money. They buy a car, they buy another one, things go on like this, until the situation changes and money becomes scarce. One is forced to sell one of the cars and then the other. This points to the fact that people are no longer in control of the economy and business. People have been removed from the objective course of business life. I presented this for the first time in 1908 in Nuremberg, but people understood little about it. It was the same during the spring of 1914, when I said in Vienna that everything is headed toward a great world catastrophe. Human beings are no longer included in concrete reality. They are becoming more and more a part of the abstract, and it is obvious that abstraction inevitably leads to chaos. But people could not understand this. Footnote Nuremberg, The Apocalypse of St. John, Lectures on the Book of Revelation, London, Rudolf Steiner Press, 1993, 12 lectures, June 17th to the 30th, 1908, Vienna, The Inner Nature of Man and Our Life Between Death and Rebirth, London, Rudolf Steiner Press, 1994, 8 lectures, April 6th to the 14th, 1914, end of footnote. Now, above all else, if we have a heart for education, we must bear in mind that we have to free ourselves from abstraction and work our way back to concrete reality, realizing that everything depends on the human being. We should not emphasize too strongly the need for teachers who have a thorough knowledge of geography, history, English, or French. Rather, teachers must understand the human being. Teachers should build their teaching on the basis of real knowledge of the human being. Then, if necessary, they can sit and look in an encyclopedia for the material they need for teaching. If people do this while standing firmly on the ground of a real understanding and knowledge of the human being, as teachers they will teach better than than those who have excellent degrees but lack real knowledge of the human being. Thus we come to the meaning of an art of education in the world. We know that what happens in the world is reflected in the culture of the outer world. This was easy to see in the case of the ancient Greeks. Gymnasts were seen everywhere in public life. When Greeks stood before the agora or marketplace, regardless of what they were like in other ways, it was obvious that they were educated as gymnasts. In the case of Romans, their training manifested less externally, and with us, what lives in the school is expressed by the fact that life increasingly escapes us. We grow out of life, no longer into it. We have no idea of the degree to which our accounting systems lead their own independent life, life so removed that we have lost all power over it. It takes its own course, leading an abstract existence based on numbers. Just consider those who are highly educated. At best, we recognize them because they wear glasses, or perhaps not, on their attenuated little organ. Education today has significance only because it is gradually undermining the significance of the larger world. We must bring the world, the real world, back into the schools. Teachers must stand within this world with a lively interest in everything in the world. Only when teachers are of the world can the world be brought into the schools in a living way. The world must live within the schools. Even if this happens only playfully at first, then in an aesthetic way and gradually finding expression, it is nonetheless imperative that the world lives in the school. So today it is more important than ever to emphasize this approach of mind and heart in our new education, and to be rethinking our methods. Many of the older methods are still good, and what I have been saying is certainly not meant to cast a shadow over the excellent educators of the 19th century. I appreciate them fully. In fact, I see those 19th century teachers as people of genius and great capacity, and they were the children of an intellectual time. They used their capacity to work toward the intellectualizing of our age. People today have no idea how much they have been imbued with intellectuality. Here we come to the real significance of renewed education, that we free ourselves from intellectuality. The various branches of human life will be able to reunite. People will understand what it means when education was seen as a means of healing, which was connected with the significance of human beings. There was a time when the idea or image of the human being was this. When we were born into earthly existence, we were actually a stage below human. We had to be educated and healed in order to rise and become truly human. Education was therapeutic and a part of medicine and hygiene. Today everything is divided. Teachers are placed alongside the school doctor, outwardly separate. But this just doesn't work. To place teachers side by side with the school doctor is like looking for a tailor who makes the left side of a coat and for another who makes the right side, with no idea about who might sew the two parts together. Likewise, if we take the measurements of teachers who are not trained in medicine, the right side of the coat, and then take the measurements of the doctor who is not trained in education, the left side, who will sew them together? We must actively rid ourselves of the left and right tailors and replace them with the one who can make a whole coat. Impossible situations seldom appear unless life has been greatly limited, not when life is springing up and bubbling over. This is why it is so difficult for people to understand the meaning of Waldorf education. Sectarian efforts away from life is the opposite of what it intends. On the contrary, it works intensively to enter life. In such a short lecture course, it is clearly possible to give only a short overview of everything involved. I have attempted to do this, and I hope it may have been stimulating. I will conclude our course in the final lecture, the end of Lecture 9.